Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bloom Basics VM and Linux on System Z Part 3 teleconference. This call is being recorded. To access today's materials, please check your calendar invitation or go to SSI, Business Partners, please check Partner World. The presentation materials, transcript, and audio file of today's call will remain on the web for 6 months. And now I'd like to turn the call over to Julie Liesenfeld. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Catherine, and welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us to our final day of our Blooming Basics. Our format again today will be three presentations running about 55 minutes each with a five-minute break in between. As Catherine said, the handouts are posted on the ZVM T3 website, Partner World, and on SSI. If you're looking on SSI for the handouts, look for the three with the date of 6-24-10, Part 3. We are recording these sessions, and we'll be posting the individual MP3s next week on all three websites. Pam, Christina, and I are your hosts, and we will be doing a second series of basic topics for ZVM and Linux, probably in the September time frame. If there's a topic you're interested in, please send us an email. That would be Julie V or pchristy@us.ibm.com. Our first topic today is ZVM performance introduction. Bill will be pausing several times for questions throughout his presentation. And Bill, I'm going to throw it over to you.
Thank you, Julie. Good afternoon to everyone on the phone. Welcome to the ZVM performance introduction session. My name is Bill Bittner. I'm the ZVM performance team lead here in the ZVM development lab in Endicott, New York. And so we're going to go through a presentation today that's not meant to give you everything there is about ZVM performance, but to give you an introduction to it, talk about some of the concepts and the techniques that we use there. So if we move on to chart three, as I said, I'll talk a little bit about some definitions of performance, some guidelines, and so forth. Then we'll take a little change and talk about ways that we look at performance in ZVM, whether it be commands that are part of the product proper or other performance tools and so forth. Following this session, there'll be a session by Mike Donovan on Performance Toolkit, which we'll go into a little bit more detail of what I'll touch on there. I'll also talk about a few concepts and so forth. Then we'll go through a case study. It's not a common problem that we'll look at, but the technique or the methodology that we use will be illustrated there. And then I'll leave you with just a few final thoughts of things that I run into from time to time in doing performance work. My role here in the lab is split up across a couple different things. Some of it working with the team as we measure and set the criteria and help with the design of the actual ZVM product from release to release. But then also a good portion of my time is spent working with customer situations and problems. So I have exposure to both those things. And I'll share some of the common sort of problems along those lines. So if we move on to chart four, one of the things that often comes up is we talk about performance. As I said, I get involved with customers and performance problems. And when that occurs, I always ask three questions. What do you mean by problem? What do you mean by performance? And we'll come to the third question a little bit later. And this can be important, especially in some of the newer environments, even more so when we're introducing Linux into the mix. That it really is beneficial to take some time to make sure that we're using terminology that all parties are in agreement with as to what it means. You know, for example, here, when we define performance, we're getting involved at times where a new processor is going to be brought into a shop. And one party may say, well, this is going to give you 20% better performance. But if we don't really talk about what that performance really means, is it the utilization of the processor? Is it throughput? Is it response time? Those sorts of things are important to work through and understand that. So I have a couple lists here of things that could be definitions of performance, or it could be a combination of all these things. And even some of these items within themselves, it often pays to try to better articulate what it really means. For example, user supported. Well, I can create two different benchmarks or two different configurations that have vastly different number of users supported. Some of that could be depending on, well, users with sub-second response time or any kind of response time. Right? So understanding those definitions are important. One of the items there is consistency, right? Because one of the things that we tend to hate more than bad response time is bad response time when seconds earlier it was great, right? We can get used to some birdie bad performance, but when it's inconsistent like that, it tends to be even worse. So sometimes there's a measure of that or a character of that wrapped into this as well. So I encourage folks, especially as you're working through service level agreements, rollouts of new products, things like that, that as you talked about performance, you define it clearly for everyone involved. So if we move on to chart five, we're going to start looking at guidelines now for the system. And ZVM is one of those things where a lot of us engineers, we don't like to look at instructions. Right, we like to just play with it and figure out how it goes. ZVM is one of those things where it's beneficial to actually read the instructions up front, work through some of the guidelines and the information that's there, go back to some of the things that you're hearing in the Blooming Basics sessions and so forth. So I'm going to talk about some guidelines in the following areas here that I have listed. We'll go through them one at a time. So moving on to chart six, starting with the processor guidelines, we do support what I'll refer to as dedicated processors in a ZVM environment. And so this is the idea where the logical processors that ZVM owns in the partition that's given to the ZVM system, I can take those and dedicate them to virtual machines, meaning the only thing that will run on that logical processor is the virtual machine that's dedicated to it. I find that tends to be mostly used in political environments. It's not really the best technical solution. From a technical perspective, I'll tend to recommend that we use absolute share settings. But I list there some of the differences with dedicated processors. Share settings, for those that are familiar with LPAR environments, think of that kind of as the weight setting that you would use in an LPAR environment, except there's a few more options with ZVM share settings. The two main categories are absolute and relative. Absolute is a percentage from up to 99% of the system resources, right? So it's not of an individual IFL if you're on a multiple IFL environment. It's of the system, right? So a logical two-way, an absolute 50% would be roughly equivalent to one IFL there. Relative share settings is a number from 1 to 10,000, with 100 being the default. And it's relative to what other virtual machines want to run in the system. All right, so that's important to remember that both the absolute share setting and the relative share settings, these values only really come into play for the virtual machines that are competing for resources. If they're not logged on or if they're logged on but sitting truly dormant, they don't come into play with this. We have with the share setting what I often refer to as a target minimum or a normal share, and then also a limit share or a maximum share. One of the flavors for those limit or maximum shares is limit hard, and the other one is limit soft. Limit hard says hold this virtual machine back no matter what. So even if the actual machine sits idle, we're going to hold this virtual machine back to a certain level. Whereas limit soft says, well, hold them back until everybody else gets the resources that they need or want, and then allow this machine to get any excess. So one of the footnotes I have here is that do not use limit hard settings unnecessarily. What I mean by that is we've had customers that in an effort to try to avoid looping virtual machines or runaway virtual machines, they'll set a limit hard setting rather low. The problem with that is those virtual machines may still run away and loop. They'll just do it a lot slower, and it may be more difficult to notice that. So I tend to really recommend the limit hard values, only if you're trying to limit resources from a test perspective or for a contractual perspective. That is, if you're selling MIPS on the system or something along those lines. If you do use the limit hard, there was an APAR that went out last fall, VM64721, which allows it to be even more accurate. We were having some problems in the field where the limit hard value was either over-limiting or under-limiting to some extent. But with this APAR and making a change to the set SRM settings, we found that we can make that very accurate. Another note that I have here is do not define more virtual processors than are needed. I've run into situations where the customer has a physical 16-way. So they define all their partitions as 16 ways, and then they define all their virtual machines as 16 ways, and that's over-provisioning it. We're going to end up spending a lot of extra cycles managing those when it's not clear that they're really needed. There are some middleware and software products that will have some recommendations or some minimum entries for that, such as some that will require or recommend that you always have at least two virtual processors. But looking at those guidelines and not defining more than you can actually consume will end up keeping your resources down and your overhead down. Finally, there I have a note about a small minor time slice. So that's the SRM dispatch slice value. Some folks that are perhaps back to ZVM after a decade or two may recall in the past we'd often play with that value to try to lower the VM overhead. On today's systems and today's configurations and workloads, there's really not much value in that. And so letting the minor time slice just default is usually what we recommend to do that. So if we move on now to chart 7, we'll talk a little bit about memory guidelines. And this is really an area where my saying of it depends really comes into play. So we'll often have people that talk about the virtual to real memory ratios. And there's a lot of rules of thumb here, and they're really meant just to be starting points. So what I tend to recommend is you shouldn't have your virtual to real ratio greater than 3:1 unless you really have done a whole lot of extra homework to make sure that your system can avoid that. To remove any possibility of extra performance overhead, you need to keep the ratio 1:1. So it's really a matter of how much overhead can I afford to have in my environments and so forth. We don't have time on this call to get into all the details of that. There is a web page that we put out there with the URL listed there that goes into a little bit more detail and also has a pointer to another web page that will go into even more detail about how you can look at the paging on your system and memory requirements and so forth. So that can be handy there. There are a couple options that you can use to give priority to virtual machines in terms of memory. The one that I tend to recommend is the set reserve command, which basically says, for a given virtual machine, I want to reserve a number of frames of real memory for that machine. How that comes into play is in various places in VM's memory management where we're looking to reclaim pages to be used elsewhere or frames, as we start to take pages away from this virtual machine with reserve frames, we will hold off once we get down to that reserve count and move on to somebody else, so sort of reserving some space for that. I tend to recommend that above lock. Lock tends to be stronger in terms of less choice or less flexibility for that. We still recommend that you define some of your System Z processor memory as expanded storage. Now, ZOS had dropped their support for expanded storage when they did their 64-bit support. We still use it in ZVM, and we tend to use it for some valuable work there. Again, a URL is listed there in terms of some of the benefits and some of the things to look at there and some rules of thumb. It really helps us from the perspective of having a paging hierarchy. We will use reference bits to try to approximate least recently used from a memory perspective. So as we go to steal pages from central storage or real memory and move it down to expanded storage, we sort of approximate that based on the hardware reference bits. However, once in an expanded storage, we can timestamp things and be very accurate as to what are the oldest pages there to move out to disk, right? And so we get the most benefit from that. We also can use expanded storage very efficiently in those scenarios. There are a number of options or methods to share memory across virtual machines, primarily DCSSs and NSSs, which again, we don't have time to go into here, but when you can do those sorts of things, especially in environments where you can share that across tens or hundreds of virtual machines, you can end up having some real savings in resource requirements. And that's another reason why the rule of thumb for virtual to real memory depends. You know, if you're sharing a whole lot, yeah, you can probably overcommit that more than you would otherwise. The last section here, I talk about size guests appropriately. We run into a lot of scenarios where I'll work with a customer and I'll come in and see that the virtual machine is 4 gig. And I'll ask, well, why is that virtual machine 4 gig? And I'll say, well, the Intel box that we moved it from was 4 gig. And I'll ask, well, why was it 4 gig there? And there have been times when they'll say, well, because when we bought that box, the only options were 2 gig and 4 gig, and we knew 2 gig was too small. So in that case, we don't really know that it needs the full 4 gig, but that's what got moved over. So again, there's some different approaches that you can use to size the guest appropriately there. What we want to do is balance that we're not over-provisioning it, because the guest, particularly Linux, is going to use that memory. It's going to think that that's real from its perspective, and it'll try to use all of it. And it may not be the best use of that real memory. At the same time, we don't want to force the virtual machine, if it's a guest operating system, into paging a whole lot on its own. So we don't want to squeeze it down too small. One of the methods people use for a Linux environment is to attach a virtual disk in storage, which you can think of that as a pageable RAM disk, and use that as a swap disk. So if you're off a little bit in your calculations for this, the swapping or what's really paging at the Linux level won't hurt as much as if it was really going to disk. Okay, so let's move on to chart 8, which talks about paging guidelines. Now, there are formulas in the CP Planning and Admin book that talk about how much paging space you should use, right? I do encourage folks to look at that as they're building their systems and designing things. One of the quick things to look at from a performance perspective is using Query Alloc Page or the Performance Toolkit or Omegamon XE, all give you access to this, to see how full that paging area is. And the rule of thumb is after you get about 50% full, your performance will start to drop off. If you fill up all of your paging space, we will spill over in the spool. If you fill that up as well, the system will abend. This tends to be one of the most common things that people will run into is they will do the homework up front when they first build their ZVM system. Maybe they'll have done that for a proof of concept, but they won't come back and revisit that later. And what happens then is they'll start to add virtual machines. You know, the proof of concept went really well, so they'll roll out a whole bunch of new ones. And as a result of that, they end up needing more page space. So you want to keep an eye on that. The primary reason we do that is so that we can do block paging out to disk, which gives us some efficiencies in different areas. So if you really get into performance, the thing that I really encourage you to look at is the block reads per paging request. When you start to see that drop, that's probably an indication that your paging space is filling up because we're having difficulty finding contiguous slots on disk on which to page out. And again, there's a pointer to where you can find that information. Multiple volumes, multiple paths, right, so we can get dynamic I.O. going on there and so forth. We recommend that you don't mix page extents with any other kind of extents on the same volume. That's good for performance. It's good for availability. It's good for making DR environments easier to manage. A lot of goodness that come from that. We do recommend that your paging volumes be of all the same characteristics from a geometry and performance perspective. Don't mix 3390 mod 9s with mod 1s. Don't mix solid-state disk with traditional spinning disk. Keep it of a like nature. Now, you do have some trade-offs and some decisions. We can also do paging to FCP SCSI, as they're defined as EDEVs, emulated devices to VM. That tends to have some more, some higher path lengths and therefore processor requirements, but we've also seen that you can get a higher paging bandwidth in some scenarios there. Now, let me mention here that a lot of that depends on which SCSI devices are you using, right? Not all SCSI devices are created equal. You can get a vast variety of performance characteristics there. Also, those that are coming back to ZVM from decades ago may have recalled the old advice that you never enable cache for ZVM paging. Well, that's no longer true anymore, and we do recommend that you have that. There's also a pointer here that goes into a little bit more detail about some of these characteristics and so forth to look at. So with paging guidelines done, let's move on to chart 9 and talk a little bit about mini disk cache. I do encourage that you enable some real storage for mini disk cache. I tend to have a philosophy where be generous with mini disk cache from a perspective of what you enable for it, but make sure that you do disable for things like mini disks that are mapped to VM data spaces, Linux swap devices that are write mostly or don't have those kind of characteristics that we like for mini disk cache. Backup applications, right? Your backup programs tend to be read once, write once anyway, but also they use very sophisticated I/O channel programs that won't benefit with mini disk cache. In large storage environments, and what I mean by large here is when you start getting up to 8 gig or larger, you probably want to bias against mini disk cache or set mini disk cache limits there. That will give you some better performance for that. And then if we move on to chart 10, just some things to think about from a server machine perspective. In ZVM, it's very common to have certain facilities implemented in a virtual machine. For example, our TCPIP stack runs in CMS in a virtual machine. Our security manager, RACF, for VM, runs in a virtual machine. I tend to think of those as extensions to the operating system. And as that, you want to give them some special treatment. And so some things listed here are things like quick disk spawn. That will prevent those virtual machines from ever having to sit timeout in something called the eligible list. Depending on their processor requirements, I may tend to give them a higher share setting. I may also reserve pages for them. I may turn off mini disk cache's fair share limitation so that they can use as much mini disk cache as they want. Those are all good things because a lot of those facilities, other virtual machines are dependent on. In an environment, say, where the way I get access to all my virtual machines is through the VM stack, if that's the case, then I don't want my VM stack to ever wait because when it waits, everybody else has to wait. The last bullet here is kind of interesting. In a well-running system, a lot of these virtual machines may not be your top virtual machines, right? Depending on how you configure Performance Toolkit or your performance product, it may only keep the top 10 or 100 virtual machines, right? But you want to make sure that you also get these virtual machines in some of that data. That way, if things do run poorly at some point in the future, you have something to compare it to, right? Because I mentioned I ask three questions when I get involved in a situation. What do you mean by performance? What do you mean by problem? And my third question is almost always, what did you change? Right? And so this idea of having before and after data can be very helpful for answering that type of question. Okay, I think I'll pause now and turn it back to Catherine to see if there's any questions out there.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, press star one at this time. Again, if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment or pick up your handset. Again, it is star one for questions. And no one has signaled at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Catherine. So why don't we continue now? I'm going to talk about what are some things that you can use to look at performance on your system. Now, ideally, I recommend that you get a performance product to do this kind of work. And ideally, I prefer that you get the ones offered by IBM. But I do want to talk a little bit about what is there in the native ZVM system that you can look at. And so on chart 11 is the first item, the CP indicate command. And there's a number of options on this. I'm not going to bore you with going through each one of these. You can use the help facility on VM to look up any one of these or the actual manuals themselves to get information on it. But some of these are very useful commands to look at and so forth. So let's look at one on chart 12 here. And my example here is the indicate load. One of the things to bear in mind with this is a snapshot in time. The numbers reported here tend to be smooth averages over the past 4 minutes, right? So if you do indicate load and then compare it to some things from performance toolkits or elsewhere, you may not see the exact number or the exact same number. It may be dependent on how things are smoothed with indicate load and so forth. Also, indicate load isn't aware of the fact that it may be running in a virtualized environment itself, you know, second level on ZVM, or in a logical partition. And so depending on how you have weight set and things like that, some of the numbers here can be affected by that. But this is a good command to get a quick look at how things are running on the system and so forth. There are two forms of this. There's a Class G, which any virtual machine can use, and then there's a specific one for privileged user that gives you a little bit more detail. Okay, moving on to chart 13, one of my favorite options on the indicate command is indicate queues, and in this case it's actually indicate queue expanded, where what you see here is each of the virtual machines that are in the dispatcher eligible list, right? So the ones that are completely idle, we don't really display here. They're listed there. If these virtual machines actually had multiple virtual processors, there'd be an indication of that as well. In this case, these are all defined as virtual one-ways. And so in column two, what you see is a Q and a number, or an E and a number, or an L and a number. And that delineates what dispatch list they're in. So it's either in the dispatch list, the eligible list, or L for limit list. So the Q ties it to the dispatch list and so forth. So this is a quick way. I'll have customers sometimes say, I believe one of my virtual machines is hung. Do indicate queue? Do I see it in the eligible list? Well, chances are I need to look at certain tuning values from that perspective then. The third column there can be helpful is that gives the state of that virtual machine at that time. So you see a couple of virtual machines there that have I/O. Which really means they're waiting for I/O to complete in that virtual machine. You see the Bittner virtual machine there is R and then 00. That really means that it's actually running or dispatched on processor 0, which in this case would happen because I'm the one that issued the indicate queue command here. And R without a number means it's waiting for CPU. And so there's different things that you can look at for this. Again, bearing in mind that this is a instantaneous snapshot in time as to what's going on in the system. So occasionally you may want to do a few of these to get a feel for what's going on, kind of a poor man's state sampling. Okay, let's move on to chart 14. These are just some of the query commands that are out there. I won't go into these in any kind of detail, but I did want to mention them. Now, one of the things that I encourage people to do from time to time is spool your console, that is, save the output that's coming from commands, and issue the query commands for all these options, and then save that. Right? Because later on, when I ask what changed, we can do this again. And there's been times when I've found things like, oh, this SRM setting changed. Do we know why or how? So things like that can be valuable. So again, just some motherhood there of some good stuff to do. Okay, on chart 15, this is kind of the food chain for the performance data in ZVM. And you'll see another flavor of this in Mike Donovan's presentation in a little bit, where the things in blue there are the parts of the ZVM product proper, right? And so the key to this is that long oval near the bottom called the Star Monitor System Service. That's the heart of what creates and generates and captures all the performance data that we're dealing with. And there's a lot of different ways that you can get access to that. It all deals with something having been written to talk to that system service. Now, what makes this system service a little bit different from some of the other ones that VM provides is that data is actually passed back and forth by shared memory. So if you see that square on the right-hand side called non-DCSS segment, that's really shared memory between CP and a virtual machine. And so I have a couple examples here of VMRM, the VM Resource Manager, getting data from that. Performance Toolkit, which Mike will go into much more detail, how that connects to it. And there's also a little utility that is part of ZVM called MonWrite. That's pre-installed. You just need to potentially give it some more disk space. And its job is really just to capture the raw monitor records and write it out in a MonWrite format. And I'll come back to that again later on in a little bit more detail. In addition, I show some sort of salmon or pink objects here which deal with Omegamon XC. Again, Omegamon XC is a Tivoli product. Its presentation of material is just like the other Omegamon XC platforms and so forth. That is going to work off of Performance Toolkit data, all right? And we'll talk a little bit about that. And in many cases, we can look at this data through a green screen, 3270, or also most of the products out there today have a browser interface for that as well. In many cases, it's the same data, just presented differently. There are a few more features in terms of a graphical presentation, obviously, through the browser. Okay, chart 16 is just some background. I won't go into this, but background on the Omegamon XC for ZVM and Linux. So both components are included with that product. The Performance Toolkit, as Mike will describe, is a priced feature that ships with ZVM. So it is pre-installed, but you need to do some things to turn it on and to pay for it. The Omegamon XC is a separate product altogether. It would have to be ordered appropriately. It could tie into the other Tivoli management services. So if I move on to chart 17, those that are familiar with this, the TEP and TEPS, TDW, the Tivoli Data Warehouse and so forth, all that infrastructure plugs into this. What's kind of interesting here is you see in the middle there's a DCSS. That's different than the MON DCSS. That's, again, going to be shared memory between the Performance Toolkit and a Linux virtual machine that runs a special VM agent that's going to be talking through that whole Tivoli management services infrastructure. So it's kind of some neat technology in and of itself as to how they did that. So, again, we don't have time to really go into that. If you have a Omegamon XC in your shop elsewhere, I highly encourage you to investigate this as well in a ZVM Linux environment. And even if you don't, there can be some neat capabilities there in terms of automation, of alerting, signaling, and things like that. So I have included on charts 18 and 19 some screenshots of some of the new capability in the Omegamon XC that you may want to take a closer look at. And I believe Mike may refer to this later as well. Okay, so let's move on now to chart 20 and talk a little bit more about some performance characteristics and concepts. One of them is state sampling here on chart 20. And this is the idea of periodically sampling the state of a machine or a device, capturing that data, and then going back to say, all right, I looked at that machine 100 times, 50 of those times it was waiting for CPU, Therefore, 50% of the time, it waits for CPU. Right? And there's different ways of doing this. We talked earlier about the indicate queues expanded command that gives you that information. In monitor, there's actually that capability itself. So by default, every 2 seconds, VM is looking at every virtual processor, understanding what its state is, and keeping track of that. It will then later write all that information out through the monitor sample information. And this shows up in Performance Toolkit in the user state sampling report and the device reports. So it's a good way of getting some information on this. Now, let me comment that we don't sample at a high enough frequency to be completely accurate or to duplicate an exact picture of what's going on. But it can be helpful for giving you a hint as to where to look first for your different problems and so forth. Okay? And again, we'll come back to that actually in the case study that we walk through. On chart 21, we're going to talk a little bit about I.O. performance. And this is going to be old knowledge for folks that are coming over from ZOS performance or have been doing performance for a while. But here I'm talking about what I'll refer to as traditional I.O. in a systems Z environment, where we're doing start subchannel type I.O. And we tend to talk about I.O. response time being broken down between service time and queue time. Now, in a ZOS environment, you may think of that as IOS queue for the queue time. That service time tends to be further broken down into pending, connect, and disconnect time. And looking at each of those things tends to give us a feel for where do we need to look next. Function pending time tends to deal with time that we're spent trying to get an actual connection out to the device. And so when I see values that are higher there, and by higher I tend to mean if we're going above 1 millisecond, I may start looking at the channel contention or I/O priority queuing or things along those lines. Connect time tends to track to the amount of data being transferred. It's not as direct a track when you're using FICON channels, but it's still relatively close to that perspective. And then on chart 22, continuing on this, disconnect time, that tends to be time associated in one way or another with delays in the control unit, whether that be cache misses, control unit management time, different things like that. Now, in the architecture, there's actually a fourth time, which tends not to be used too much on today's devices, but has been there and is still part of the architecture. Most of the reporting tools will take device active time, and as they report on that, it will be included under disconnect time. Okay? So I just wanted to briefly mention some of the I.O. things there and so forth. I want to move on to chart 23 and mention two other definitions that come up a lot when we look at ZVM performance. The first one is working set size, which is probably more accurately defined as estimated working set size. Right? In CompSci class, we learned that the working set is the set of pages that an application or system needs to have, the minimum number it needs to have to really run effectively or optimally. In VM, since to a large extent the virtual machines are black boxes, we just estimate the working set size. One of the primary variables in that estimation is how many pages are resident. Right? So if you upgrade your machine and add a lot of real memory, we can have more pages resident, which makes it look like the working set sizes may have gone up. So keeping that in mind can be valuable. If you really want to track how much memory is being used by a virtual machine, on the Performance Toolkit U-Page report and things like that, you'd want to use resident pages, not the working set size. Okay? So just something to watch out for that. The other thing to look out for here is often in some of the reports and data, you'll hear transactions. Again, this is just ZVM's estimation of what constitutes a transaction. Since VM really can't see what the end user may be doing, especially in an environment where the true end users may be coming in through IP in some way to a Linux application, we can only estimate what transactions really are made up. So unless you're really in a pure CMS environment, I tend not to really look at the transaction numbers. because what happens there is, in many cases, a Linux virtual machine will look like one really, really long transaction. And think about what happens with, you know, periodically, maybe a couple times a day, that transaction ends from a VM perspective. Well, you know, a day-long transaction can really skew the response time numbers, right? And so you want to watch out for that. In a Linux environment, I tend to stay away from the transaction reports in Toolkit and elsewhere. Chart 24 is just a list of where some other information is. We can get a little bit more detail. So the first one there, the performance manual, tends to be more detail on the guidelines and structure and components of ZVM products that deal with performance. If you're looking for speeds and feeds and performance benchmarks and so forth, then you will want to go to the second item here, which is the web page, the performance section. The third one there is actually a component of that where we have some tips. We'll have a list on there of common problems and solutions. And I'll warn you, some of the solutions are don't do that, right? Some additional guidelines and so forth. Additionally, there are some developer pages out there. I try to put some of my presentations out there along with the speaker notes. Some of them are a little dated, but still accurate. And so you're welcome to go out there and look at that. Again, if you look at that material and you have questions, just let me know there. So we've talked about the guidelines. I've talked about a little bit how to look at the system and so forth. So why don't we pause briefly again to see if there's any questions at this point. So, Catherine, if you could check for questions.
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, please press star 1 if you have a question or a comment. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing star 1. And we have no questions at this time.
Okay, thank you, Catherine. All right, so let's move on to a case study. This is one from several years ago. I still use it, not because the problem is common, but because it's good for illustrating some of the methodologies we use. So if we start on chart 26, this was a scenario where we'd just come back from the holidays, and people appeared in my office and very concerned about performance on our production system here where we do our development. And so what you see on this chart on the top is a section of one of the Performance Toolkit reports, the USTAT report, which is that state sampling information. Now, in this case, it's a roll-up of all the virtual machines on our system. And what you see there is that I've highlighted percent IOW, which stands for IO weight. So in this case, the virtual machines that are active, 19% of the time, they're waiting for I.O., which, knowing our system, is high, right? We tend not to want to wait on I.O. devices. We would prefer to be waiting on processor or not waiting at all. So based on that, I know, okay, it's I.O. related. Let me bring up the Performance Toolkit report for devices, so FCX 108. Now, as you'll see later on, there's ability to sort and do different things like that through Performance Toolkit. So doing that, I found one of the devices that was showing some of the highest performance numbers in terms of badness was this device 1742, which was a disk. You can see the I.O. rate there, 26.7. And then we see a breakdown of the service time and response time. All right, so I've highlighted response time in red as 69 milliseconds. Now that's a very long time for modern disk. And even though this was several years ago, it was still a very high response time for that. And I can see, if I go over to the second column from the right, the number of requests queued on average is 1.2. So there's almost always somebody waiting in this scenario here based on that sampling. When I look at the service time and how that's broken down, I see the biggest component of that is disconnect time, right? And so we talked about how disconnect time is associated with the control unit and so forth. So what we decided to do is we wanted to look at the control unit report or the report that gives us a little bit more detail from the control unit's perspective on these devices, which is the cache extended device, or the FCX 177 report. But I went to look for that, and it didn't exist for this device, which seemed rather odd. Now, being a good performance person, we keep historical data. So I was able to go back and see what was going on previously. So if we move on to chart 27, what I have here is a comparison on the top from the FCX 108 report and then what was available for the FCX 177 report on the bottom there. Going back to a December 8th date, which is a date that I suspected to have sort of a similar load on the system. And a couple of things you'll note here is that the I.O. rate was actually higher back in December, but giving us better service time and performance. So down on the FCX 177 report, what we can see are some statistics from the December 8th data where we were getting control unit information. Now, the first two columns, you see total cache and total SCMBK. So total cache means the total number of IOs the control unit thinks are targeted for this device. And the SCMBK number is how many IOs are coming from the host system that we're looking at. So by seeing that these are different, 53 from the control unit perspective and 41 from the host, I also know that this device is most likely not only shared, but there's another system that's also trying to do I.O. to it as well. And then if I go further to the right, you see a series of percentages there that talk about the percent of I.O.s that are read I.O.s, which is 99, and then the number of hits in cache. And so we see we get a lot of benefit from the control unit cache in this perspective. And knowing that disconnect time is what increased so much, that's what was curious here. So if we move on to chart 28, one of the things that we could do at that point was issue a CP command called query DASI details on that 1742 device. And what we see there is that we get some information about cache details. And so you'll see cache, NVS, CFW, DFW, and so forth. And we get that at the subsystem level, which is a control unit, and then also at the device level. Okay, and so non-volatile storage, yes, cache on the device, all those are good. Now, what was bad here, though, is an F under the subsystem for cache and a yes for PIN data, right? So that's the first F I'd seen since 8th grade English, and I think the teacher just didn't like me. But in this case, the F really stands for failure. You'll also see a Y for yes under PIN data, and so on this older 3990 control unit, what it would do is for this data that was being written out to disk, it would cache in its non-volatile storage, so it's battery backed up and so forth. But if it had trouble writing data out to disk at some point and couldn't use spare tracks and things like that, it would end up pinning data and sending messages out that, you know what, you need to fix me and write this stuff out to make sure that we have data integrity here. I'm going to keep the data in my non-volatile storage and keep that battery backed up. And what this device would actually do is at some point it would say, you know what, I'm not going to cache anymore until you pay attention to me and fix me, right? And so this isn't a very common problem, especially these days. It just doesn't happen, but back then there were scenarios where it would. We know that's a problem. And so then if we move on to chart 29, this is another performance toolkit screen. This is actually the device details report, which goes into a little bit more detail on the devices. So you'll see some of the same characteristics that we saw with the FCX 108 report, where you get the breakdown of service time and response time and so forth. But if we page down this report, which is what's on chart 30, one of the cool things we also get from this is a breakdown of the mini disks on this device. And in the far right column, you see an approximation of the mini disk IOs, these devices. And so the device that was important here, or at least in this snapshot where we looked at it, was this database 233 disk that's at the bottom of the chart. Now, for those of us that know our system, that's a key disk to be able to do any kind of development on the ZVM stuff that we're working on. And so everybody waiting on that device and having poor performance for that was impacting a lot of people. And I think we actually had a deadline coming up, so that made the stress and the pressure even higher. But through that, we got to identify, okay, that's the disk that's important. If we needed to, we could have moved that off to another volume. We had all sorts of ways of working around that. So we were able to identify what was being hurt and what was the real root cause of that. So chart 31, the solution there, there's also another CP command that actually allows you to identify exactly what tracks are pinned and so forth, and we were able to deal with that. Now, again, pin data is very rare. We would see it part because we would get the older devices and so forth here to work with. But if you think about that methodology, going back and okay, what are virtual machines waiting on? Okay, it's I/O. Which I/O devices are giving us abnormal performance and so forth? And sort of peeling the layers of the onion down to you get at some of the root answers. That kind of methodology is helpful in terms of doing that as opposed to just guessing where it might be. Okay, so on the last chart, 32, I just want to leave you with a few final thoughts of some other things to bear in mind. The first one is collect data for a baseline of good performance, right? It's why all of us that are health conscious go to the doctor on a regular basis and get tests done just so that it was a baseline, right? What my heart rate is different from other people. And having a baseline to be able to detect something's wrong here, you need to have that baseline, right? Collecting that data in scenarios, as I talked about, there's that Monrite utility. So, you know, worst case, even if you don't look at this data, collect it and save it. Some really critical places to collect it is if you're going to do a push-pull on a processor, right? So you're bringing in a new processor, collect data before you get rid of the old one. Collect it and save it so that if something unexpected happens on the new processors, we have something to compare there. That's very helpful. Same sort of thing if you're rolling out a new application, a new release of VM, a new release of Linux, things like that are definitely key points in which you should make sure you have that baseline. I would prefer you have the baseline all along, but in most cases, those critical ones are the most important. Implement change management process. Right? I already warned you, I'm going to ask you, what did you change? Some of the shops that are difficult to work with are some of the larger ones where they have a lot of people making changes and not talking to one another. Right? So having that kind of change management process can really be beneficial even from a performance perspective. Making as few changes as possible at a time, right? So, sometimes because of the limited number of change windows and things like that, we try to sneak in multiple changes at once, right? And so if I make two different tuning changes, one could actually make things better, one could make things worse. If I do them together, it looks like neither one were beneficial. So trying to make as few changes as possible. Performance is often only as good as the weakest component, right? Those that are audiophiles know that I have the best receiver in the world, but if my speakers are lousy, I'm not going to have good sound, right? If I have batch processing that involves tape, I can have the fastest processor in the world, but if I have really poor I/O configuration for my tapes, I'm not going to have good performance there. Related to that is this next bullet of relieving one bottleneck will reveal another. Right, so if you're adding faster processors, you may need to look at, do I need to add more channels or more I/O or more memory? There's relationships between the two that you want to be aware of. And related to that is the last one, latent demand is real. If virtual machines and activity is delayed or waiting, queued because of a resource limitation, if you relieve that resource limitation, work may come in even faster, and so you need to be prepared to deal with that. So that's the material I have for you today. We have a few minutes left here, so I ask Catherine to see if there's any more questions now or any new questions, but I appreciate hearing from you all.
Thank you. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to queue up for a question or comment today, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. And again, ladies and gentlemen, that's star 1. And we have no additional questions at this time.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you all for participating and listening. Julia, I believe I'll hand it back to you.
Hey, Bill, thank you so much. And Catherine, we'll go ahead and take a break for 4 minutes, and then we'll start up again.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You will be on hold with music until the conference resumes.